Okay, you know, it sort of depends who's on, who's involved. You know, when Fleming came back to his dirty petri dishes because he was too lazy to clean them and noticed that something was inhibiting the growth of bacteria, there are probably microbiologists would just shrug their shoulders and throw it into the dishwasher instead of trying to figure out what the hell went wrong and discovering penicillin. So, you know, some of us have worked better with eureka moments than others. I am sure that your one has worked very well with them. I don't know what to tell you. I'm the type of guy, I appreciate the simplification. I'm sort of the guy who comes into things with a plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, and plan E. It's a little excessive, I know, but it's just the way I'm wired.
I'm just saying that even a failed experiment is a tremendous educational aspect.
Yeah, in theory, to those people who understand what's going on or have the curiosity to figure it out, there's an unfortunate number of people who have very strong muscles that shrug, and they just do a lot of shrugging in their lives. They add it up, and then they throw it away, and they do something completely different. So you and me, hopefully, we're kind of curious people. We want to know why it failed. It's not enough to say it failed, but obviously there's a reason why. And if you figure out the reason why, it's a good chance that you'll be able to correct for it, and then you'll have a success. But again, unfortunately, there are guys out there who just shrug their shoulders and say the damn thing didn't work, it's broken, and they just go off somewhere else.
Well, you can always sell everything. Buy a farm in Nebraska, and you'll have no shortage of room to put up your appendix.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'd have a comment from Ken of Nebraska / South Dakota if he was on Echo Link tonight. I don't think he's on there tonight, but yeah, you can do that. It takes all kinds, there are people, I think like you and me, Ed, who really want to understand what's going on. You like to present it to other people as a simpler concept because it's just easier for most people, common denominator to grasp. But we both, I think, have a curiosity of what's happening under the hood. The way I see the technical debt is it's a kind of a mix between. We're not getting too esoteric, I hope. We're not going to discuss S1 and S2s of DNAs too much. Occasionally it's nice to mention to people that such things do exist in our universe, even though we don't really discuss it too much.
Can I play for 1 second?
Slightly.
No. It's S11 and S22. Just easy. But you are wrong. Don't be sure, but hey.
Okay, very good. So just to go back to Rich, consider utilizing things like WebSDR to listen to their receivers when you're transmitting to see if it's reaching those stations, or if your radio is capable of some kind of interface with a computer and you're so inclined, look up Whisper. It's a very cute toy to play with. You send out signals, and then there are web pages you can look at with your ID, and you can get an idea of stations that receive your Whisper transmission.
Okay, the thing I'm going to try, Roy, is I'm going to follow Ed's advice about trying a long wire, random wave long wire, right into my tuner and see how well I can do. The wire will be 66 feet or longer for 40 meters and see how I can do it and take it from there. So don't want to take up any more time. Thanks, Roy. Thanks, everybody. WTBZ, back to that.
Okay, very good, Rich. As always, I wish you a lot of luck, and I hope you come back and so we can talk about it some more. You can tell us what the SWR was. My guess, if it's going to be a proper half wave, it's going to be a high impedance. It's going to be about anywhere from about the season from 2,000 to 3,000 ohms, which is a very big ratio. But we'll see. We'll see. Probably higher than most people's SWR meters are capable of displaying. But we'll see. It'll be interesting. So I wish you luck, and keep in touch. Okay, very good. Hopefully that let everything reset itself. So next on my list is Wesley. Wesley, you got to keep in mind again that you can't kind of hit the push to talk too fast, and when you drop it to reset, it's not a 5 second drop. Make it a little bit longer because otherwise the repeaters won't be hearing us.
Yeah, let me jump in one more time, NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, I just disabled the timeouts on the Selvin machine, so hopefully that'll make a difference. So maybe you want to go back to normal, as you normally do, and let's see what happens. This might be a solution. Go ahead.
Okay, Lou, fine. I'm more than happy to go back to regular. We'll see what happens. Anyway, getting back, Wesley, what's your comment, question, statement, what have you for tonight?
Yeah, I'm going to start, hold on. I'm going to start from quote, and the word in the quote might be very characteristic to the people who were fighting for the green environment. So don't be offended by that. It is real. It happened. It was done. It is doable. So I'm going to turn it to the puzzle at first. You're going to find out what I'm talking about. It has been done in America. In the land of freedom and opportunity, the information is 1.5 weeks old. And the quote, the animal called human being, which is everybody who is reading my words, including me, can be helped. Human animals, the cruel, was cruel killing other animals for food and pleasure. Destroying planet and our plant. Hunters are watching dying animals in blood and pain killed by them. For what? For pleasure? What kind of pleasure it is? Think who you are. The most vicious creatures on the planet Earth. Right? And one more happy phrase. I'm announcing more energy out than energy is in. This is not a joke. This is due to the extracting more energy from the specimen that was used to make it happen. Dr. Roy and everybody else, do you know what I'm talking about?
Hey, C2GS. Yes, I know, Wesley, what you're talking about. Hopefully everyone who's read a newspaper the last week and a half has known what you're talking about. We're talking about a report on fusion, hydrogen fusion technology. The idea is that fusion generation of electricity would be a change in the entire world. Gone would be the dangers of fission-based nuclear power. Fusion does not produce radioactive byproducts. It takes hundreds of thousands of years to decay and become less dangerous. It would revolutionize technology. Unfortunately, although it's good news, things are progressing. It is not the linchpin of the technology. We cannot go on to build a viable either industrial or personal fusion generators anytime soon. Some of the predictions are 20 to 25 years. If you ever went back to the literature in the early 1960s and looked up how long it would take at that time for fusion technology to really become viable, they would say 20 years or 25 years. So we haven't really changed much. It's good news, but it's not at this point revolutionary. I know it made the newspapers. A lot of people who don't have business degrees wrote about it, talked about it, what have you. It's good news, but it's not amazingly fantastic news. Wesley, are you there?
Yeah, I'm fighting for Roy. Can we call them?
I do have a comment, Roy.
Certainly, Ed.
I think your comment about how long it takes the nuclear products of the fission reaction to decay is a little over the top. Yes, it does take that long. The question is, to what level? Because typical nuclear power plant waste has to significantly reduce in intensity in 40 years. In 40 years, it has to be kept immersed in water. After 40 years, they can encase it in concrete for life because it cools off significantly. But yeah, as you well know, when you asymptotically approach zero, you never quite get there. So it becomes a game with how far out on that curve you really want to go before you draw your line in the sand.
I am big, I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem, Wesley. I agree with you, Ed, but to me, it's safe when you can put it into pottery. That's when it's safe. I know that's an extreme value. I realize that you have to isolate it. You don't have to isolate it as industrially later on, but you still have to isolate it for tens of hundreds of thousands of years. You can't just kind of put it as part of the pottery that you're making plates out of, which they did. They didn't make it out of the pottery, but I think they painted the uranium dye on plates back in the 30s. Strange people, those people in the 1930s.
Wait. That's a totally different issue.
I agree. I just found it interesting to me.
Is the microphone to me?
I don't know. I'm getting increasingly confused by these reset tones that are coming on and off and on and off. But we'll get to you in a second, Wesley. I just wanted to go back to ask you one last time. In theory, I agree with all that you're saying. It's just that the average Joe Schmo is a little upset by having some material that you really have to isolate. You know, sand, you don't have to isolate sand. You can go over to the beach, you can dig up a pail of sand, you can bring it home, pour it on the ground, nothing's going to happen. With radioactive material from a fission reactor, you're not going to do that in anyone's lifetime. So it's a little bit different. I appreciate that these things have half-lives, and as they have, as time goes on, they become less dangerous and less dangerous to the point where it's kind of just academic, is it dangerous or not. So I agree with you entirely in theory. In practice, it scares people, and it limits the chances of building further fission-related generators. Fusion reactors, theoretically, are much easier to sell to the average person than a fission reactor will ever be.
one, Don Blankenship, about the pupils of fossil fuels that he went to prison for.
Well, you know, there are bad things about everything. I agree. I am not optimistic about even fusion getting away with something. I am sure there's going to be a group of people, if that 20, 25 years ever comes, who are going to be making up all kinds of good reasons why fusion is not as good. They're going to talk about probably thermal pollution, and, you know, who knows what the future will bring. So I don't think anyone anywhere has the ultimate energy source. Unfortunately, the most extreme version of that problem are people who want to live like the Paleolithic people. They want to eat Paleolithic food. They want to live Paleolithically, because that's how we evolved, they say. Not keeping in mind that the average life expectancy for a Paleolithic human being was 35 years. Okay, Wes?
First, there was no nuclear material there. Second, there was no wake. Not at all. Zero, zero, nothing. Now, if you consider deuterium and tritium nuclear material, then this is not. It is just isotopes. So, 192 lasers have been pointing at a specimen as small as grain of tea. It was the size of the capsule where deuterium and tritium were heated to 3 million Celsius, imitating the process for very short periods of time and taking place in stars. In experiment, they reached 1.5 times the energy that was used for the experiment. So in physics, there is no way to get from the device more energy that was put in. But when you release the energy, the equality square, you can change the energy to mass and mass to energy. So we're talking about 1 gram of mass energy is 9 times 1,000, 13 joules. So in the sense, 1 gram of mass relates to explosive energy of atomic bomb. Let me drop it. So again, E equal mc squared seems to suggest approximately 19 terajoules of mass energy equivalent of 1 gram. So, meanwhile, the Hiroshima atomic bomb was only 50 to 75 terajoules. The bombs are powerful but crazy inefficient. So, we're talking about, for the first time in the history of human animals, based on the Greenpeace article, who is eating animals but he doesn't have to eat. And it's the most vicious creatures on the planet, Earth, and end of the quote, let me drop. We can get, we can think how many grams of how many grams of matter do we need to power entire Earth per year? And how many grams of dirt you put into your shoes, from your shoes to your house per year. Thank you very much.
Okay, AC2GS, of course. I would kind of dispute with you the terminology you're using with radioactive. Tritium is very radioactive. If I could somehow arrange for a gallon of tritiated water to be delivered to your house, you just sit there in the middle of your living room, would you enjoy that? Would you be comfortable with that? Because I wouldn't be comfortable with that in the slightest. You know, I don't need a large alpha source sitting in my living room. So it's radioactive. You might want to say it's unstable isotope, but that's what an unstable isotope is. It's radioactive.
Well, tritium is an isotope of hydrogen which allows it to blind the hydrogen radicals, forming tritiated water, H2HTO, and carbon atoms. Since tritium is low energy beta emitter, it is not dangerous externally, it's the beta particles unable to penetrate the skin. But it can be a radiation hazard if you help. And you can read about it from Wikipedia. So I have a problem with this statement. And to issue.
Again,
yes, yes.
I apologize in advance, but I gotta do it. So am I to assume that nuclear waste is less hazardous to the environment than plastic straw? Turn it back to that for the park.
This is the fun we get. It depends on your poison. You know, pick your poison, as the old saying goes. The benefit presently is that radioactive material does decay, which means it lessens its poisonousness. So if you have a very radioactive material, put it in a time machine and push it forward a billion years, it's harmless. If you have a lot of plastic, which biologically is difficult to deal with, to reduce over that period of time, it might continue to just be as poisonous a billion years from now as it is today. Now, that's not necessarily so, because as we all know from Jurassic Park, life has a way. Inevitably, there will be more and more organisms that evolve that are able to extract the potential chemical energy of plastic into food. And so just as a plant kind of sat there and rotted, it's too much of anything because the biological systems to kind of get rid of them took time to develop over time. My guess will be eventually there will be an evolution of organisms that gulp up a significant portion of available plastic particles. So ultimately, in a billion years, probably neither of those poisons will be terribly bad for us.
Comment.
Okay, Ed first, and then Wesley.
Roy, it's possible you're missing the point. The problem of plastic straw is that animals gobble them up and die. That is a very, very short-term problem. So, when the kids were young, we went to the Bronx Zoo, and we were surprised to find out you cannot get a plastic straw in the Bronx Zoo for a king's ransom. Because they were afraid someone would get into the zoo animals and kill them. That's what I thought of when I heard plastic straw. Not the fact of the non-degradation of plastic, but that goes well beyond straw.
Yeah, once again, I agree, and I'll ask Jim just to kind of cross the T's and not the I's. I thought that he was more alluding to the long-term ageless problem right now of microplastics that are spreading all over the world, that are showing up in different animals. Most biological systems have no way to clear them from their body, and so they introduce another variable, another problem that hasn't been fully addressed. So I thought that Jim was kind of having a broader kind of concept as opposed to whether plastic straws physically are just killing animals versus radioactive material. Jim, you want to kind of expand on it? Tell me if I made too much of your comment or I misinterpreted you?
No, so far it's all relevant. It's definitely an interesting topic. One of the silliest things I've ever seen in my whole life recently was a paper straw in a plastic wrapper. So I'll go back to the plastic straw for a minute. I don't use straws. I don't have any. They kind of grow themselves. Anyway, the plastic straw is the problem of the plastic straws being eaten by animals. Plastic straw that's the problem? Or is it the disgusting, disgraceful, despicable litter bugs that toss them all over the place and don't manage their waste? And go anywhere, and I don't go all night. I know I threw a big bomb in the room. Pardon me, I kind of enjoy doing that. Let's have a little fun with it if we can, and not get angry.
Fun fact.
Yes, Ed?
Two items. There are many aspects to play. Jim mentioned two. There are more. The bottom line is the flash suit does not degrade. And yes, there is an issue of animals in the flash suit spores and move up their digestive system and they die. But here's a fun fact. They do some buy in the supermarket, jumbo stores. And I had a problem with my first lawnmower. It was pretty old, and the plastic wheel rode on steel posts. There was really no bearing, it was just the plastic on the steel, and the plastic had worn. I was oversized, and the wheels were flopping around. And I found by buying some large plastic cores and cutting them up, I was able to fabricate some sleeve bearings.
Well, it only goes to show that there's utility in a lot of different things. Now, unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, my biggest pet peeve with plastics is the inability to deal with them once you use them up and you want them to go away. They don't go away. They stay around. And I think that ultimately life will supply us with a solution to that, probably after our lifespan, but I think eventually. And what can I tell you? Maybe I'm an optimist at the very end. And just for the sake of nothing, I like straws, but I don't particularly like plastic straws. I actually have a straw sitting there right in front of me with my little tumbler of ice water. It is a titanium straw. I like titanium because it doesn't give you an aftertaste. There are metal straws out there made out of steel and such that I feel give me an aftertaste. But titanium straws are real keen in my book. And you clean them. You clean all kinds of things, so why can't you clean a straw?
Comments.
Okay, I assume this is not going to be a comment about my titanium straw, but nevertheless, last comment.
Yeah, I happened to be short of time, so I will continue. So, regarding the tritium... the radioactive material. It's an isotope. We've got this small energy level beta particle. Cannot penetrate the skin. We're talking about time of exposure, so everything can be really dangerous or harmful if it's long time you put it under your pillow. Yes. So, I'm going to make a comparison. Half-life is 12.32 years. And it will become, compared to CD137, is 30.05 years, a half-life. And when we're talking about the energy level, then it is 14,949 kiloelectron volts, while cesium-137 is 512. Megaelectron volt. So, we're talking about the specimen that was used. Now, there is no waste, no nuclear waste. It's a conversion mass to the energy. And that's why this is very much important. So, can it be done in a very small glass? I assume yes. They use the specimen, the capsule, as the grain of the bean, but you have a 100 times smaller specimen, then you need 100 times smaller energy to ignite it. The achievement is with the ignition. For the first time, human animal was, I'm using the language from the Greenpeace, human being was able to produce clean energy that doesn't kill, doesn't harm, and doesn't have a waste. And that, how many grams do we need to power the Earth? It's for the first time we can say goodbye to the nuclear power station. Send to it here.
Well, let me see if I have it. Okay. It's no clear energy. It's still no clear energy. It's a fusion instead of fission. The average person on the street is not going to really understand the difference between that, and it's going to concern them, you know. But future generations will have to deal with it. And, you know, to say that tritium is less dangerous than the radioactive byproducts of fission, yeah. But still, that concerns people. If you go back to the bad old days when they used to paint watch hands with tritium, the women in charge of that would apply it with a brush, and to have a fine point, they would stick it in their mouth and lick it to kind of moisten it. And so a large number of those women, despite the incredible lack of danger, died of tritium poisoning. The beta decay you can shield yourself against it, but if you take it into your body, then you end up dying of cancer. So it is dangerous. It's less dangerous. I think we've gone down a cubbyhole. I think it's good that the advances in research of fusion is occurring. Again, I don't want people to buy stock in fusion generators because this technology is not viable. They went past the break-even point. You need a lot more than break-even point to have a viable long-term power supply. So the experts who know all of the stuff better than you or I are still putting 20 to 25 years between now and viable fusion generators. And just because something works at one scale does not mean it's a simple thing to scale it either up or down. One would think that if scaling it down requires less power and less effort, they would put it all the way down to the smallest possible to make life easier, and they would have developed this discovery 10 years ago. My guess is that these very complex devices required for this have a certain dimension. You can't scale it down too much. I might be wrong, but that's what I think. So the reason that it's the scale it is because people think that that's the best for the experiment. So we'll see 20 to 25 years if there are fusion devices. My guess is that it's probably going to take a wee longer, but I don't want to throw water on anyone's parade.
I just hear the beep. Oh, there it comes. Okay, after 30-something years in particle physics, I must agree with you, Dr. Roy. However, you can swallow something that is normally not harmful and doesn't have to be nuclear, doesn't have to be isotope. And you can harm yourself. The thing is that for the first time, human being was able to achieve something that doesn't have a waste. No fusion products. No product from decay. So one specimen is decaying to another, and another, and another, and another half-life and whatsoever. There is none. It's a pure energy conversion. So there is no problem with the waste storage, and we're not using anything that is nuclear to make it happen. It's like you have the wood and you ignited the wood. And now you have an energy. It's a heat energy. Now, we put into that specimen what? The electromagnetic wave? That's what we did. Electromagnetic wave at the wavelength of X-ray. Actually not. Actually is not. It was the laser. And then, due to bombarding, we have an X-ray. Enter X-ray.
Not quite sure where that came from or went to or any of that. It's nuclear. Tritium is a radioactive decaying product. It is not a stable product. It is a product that usually has to be manufactured someplace, and then it's a somewhat dangerous product that has to be handled correctly. Fusion has been around practically for decades. The only real, and with the same provisos that there are no radioactive product, byproducts of a fusion reaction. You get helium, which isn't a fusion, isn't a radioactively unstable material. But you still have to start with tritium in order to kind of get everything moving. The only difference between 30 years ago and now is that up until now, the amount of power used to produce the fusion was greater than the energy extractable from the fusion. That's the only difference. At this point, there's a slight increase. We're the amount of E equals MC squared mass turned to energy that you extract out of the fusion reaction is slightly higher than the energy cost it took you to produce the fusion reaction, because normally hydrogen sitting by itself at regular atmosphere temperature is not going to spontaneously fuse. You have to apply a great deal of pressure and force and heat, and then it does. And the energy to produce all those up until recently was more than the amount of extractable energy. That's the only difference between today and 10 years ago.
Thank you for that, Dr. Roy. I'm thinking about if the audience fully understand how little energy was used to this today. I mean, little but big. How is it possible that the radar can operate in mega and gigawatts of energy and is very small because of the time? So the shorter the time, the bigger the power you can produce before you have a failure of the element. So the amount of time that was used to bombard the tritium specimen was the time that it takes for the light to travel 1 centimeter. 1 centimeter is approximately less than half of an inch. And to exceed.
Light travels 1 foot per nanosecond.
Thank you for that. So we're talking 1 centimeter. 1 centimeter is less than, a little bit more than 1/3 of an inch. So we think about light traveling the distance of 1/3 of the inch. That was the time that the specimen was radiated, actually, with focused laser. Enter issue.
Okay, Wesley, they use pulse power because it's the most efficient way to manifest those levels for very, very short periods of time. We don't basically vaporize everything. So, yeah, they're using very, very high power but low time. So you're packing a lot of energy into a fraction of a time period. So, yeah, that's how they're able to get it. If they had all the power and they were going to run it constantly, probably their entire experimental system would melt down in a second or two. Yes, Ed.
Are you familiar with the celebrity death match between Takamak and Shiva?
Well, I'm familiar with the technologies involved in the past, and it's a part of the history of this glorious trip to viable fusion power generation.
let me tell the audience that at least 50 years now, research into fusion energy fairly rapidly boiled down to two approaches. One of them was a plasma maintained within a donut-shaped structure that a Russian scientist did a lot of the early work on, so to this day it's on the pantomime. I'm not sure of his name or if it's something he thought was it, you know, was his title, but it's known to this day as the pantomime. And that is continuing. Unfortunately, it's no one near as far ahead as the other one, which is the initial name of Shiva, which apparently is a, you know, Indian, Asian subcontinent goddess or something, where it is cold, where you take a fuel pellet and blast it with tremendous lasers, and then it goes off. Gives off more energy than it costs for the lasers to set it off. It was originally known as Shiva, and that is the one that is worse than Pulse. But it is possible that the Tokamak might catch up and provide you 50% of the
energy. Yeah, very good, Ed. And one of the people who invented the concept of the Tokamak was, people might actually know him, Andrei Sakharov. A very famous anti-communist guy living in the USSR, but you couldn't get away with being anti-communist.
I once saw him at a graduation speech live.
Ah, that would be interesting. Any impressions you want to share?
It was totally non-technical. It was a college graduation, and he was one of the guest
speakers. Oh, okay. I thought he would have made some kind of different type of impression. I met Linus Pauling once, and he was a charmer. I don't think of Nobel Prize winners as being charismatic charmers. But he had a twinkle in his eye and a smile on his face, and he could have sold you any used car he wanted to. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
No, I just thought when you said Sakharov, I had to say that. No, he was basically talking about, you know, what it was like in the Soviet Union, why the U.S. is not there anymore, and the benefits of the United States over the Soviet Union from someone who's been promoting them up close and personal.
Okay, you know, that's good insight. And, you know, I'm sure he could have had a cushy experience for the rest of his life in the Soviet Union and chose something else. And so I got to respect the guy. There were other guys involved. There was a guy named, I think, Igor Tamp. But Sakharov is a name that pretty much everyone knows because of what he went on to do later on. But yeah, that was a breakthrough in its time as well. I've experienced dozens of fusion technology breakthroughs in my life, and maybe that's why I've grown a wee bit jaded.
Oh, I'm sorry. In 1968, TBS Channel 13 started a new series called Nova, which is so today. One of their first episodes was about nuclear fusion, and it went into Tokamak Shiva. What I just said is what I learned at that program, what, 54 years ago?
Oh, okay, very good. I love Nova. I find it difficult to find it at times, but when I do record it and I play it, I still enjoy it a great deal. It's one of the last remaining excellent scientific documentary series. Unfortunately, it's cable TV channels kind of are going in a different direction, looking for ghosts and aliens and lost civilization. and nonsense. But Nova continues to be a very well done production. So I hope it continues endlessly.
You want to hear my all time favorite Nova episode? Only about 6-7 years ago.
Okay, sure.
There's a fairly well-known story about during World War II, the British bombed a dam, Nazi territory, and they rapidly realized that the normal conventional approaches weren't going to work, and they figured out a very unorthodox way of doing it. And Nova had a show about that. It turns out, the record, all of their design notes and everything were lost. And so Nova brought in a batch of people. It was a really big effort. They had a lot of people in England. They had some of the survivors of the raid. They had a lot of stuff that was at this point. They duplicated it. They had to go to British Columbia, because up in rural British Columbia was the only place where they were allowed them to simulate dropping bombs. And they had an old foreign plane, a C-54 or D-54, which, by the way, I have a history with that model, so that plane is near and dear to my heart. I've flown on it many times. And what they did was they tried calculating and testing and experimented to see if they could duplicate. And in the end, they figured it out. It was absolutely fascinating. Basically, the idea was to dip them across the surface by rocks, you know, flat rocks on a pond, that they would gum up the water to the dam, hit the dam, sink, and at a predetermined depth, go off and destroy the dam from below. But my favorite part of the whole thing, they were having a problem lining up the plane. So they weren't using a major dam. They built a little dam about 20 feet wide. And from the plane, they were having problems lining it up. And they also rigged up a little thing where they dropped these, like, you know, basically 55-gallon drums of concrete. They rigged up something like that. I mean, it didn't have a bomb base. But what really, really got me is the head PhD and his young grad student drove like 40 miles to the nearest big box store, and they bought some of these inflatable pool things. It was this like inflatable vinyl palm tree that was about 10 feet high. And they bored that in the lake. And they had two of them. And they had a video camera looking at the windshield of the plane.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You timed out towards the end. I heard what probably was about 90% of it. I saw that episode. I love that episode. It was kind of a peek into how, you know, actual engineering takes place, and a bunch of guys getting together and figuring out the problem and what the solutions are. It was a beautiful production. I agree with you. I don't know if I'd put it number one, because there's so much good stuff from Nova, but it's certainly one of the highlights reels.
Should I say the ending again to the
fans' audience? Certainly, yes. Please, feel free.
Did you get to the point where I have your problems lining up the plane?
Yes, you got to the point where they were buying inflatable materials to try out different things.
Yeah, well, in the Z-Box store, they found these inflatable blow-up vinyl things, and they had one was like a palm tree that had to be like 8 or 10 feet high. and there was more than Dallas afloat in the lake. A couple of them could fill a line that the plane would fly over them. And there was a camera looking out the windshield, and you can clearly see in the video how they lined up and flew over one palm tree after another. And it's just so deliciously absurd.
Will you ask to answer?
Yes, Paul.
There's an old movie in the 50s called The Dam Busters, taken from that true story. And if you ever get a chance to see it, Ed would love it if you saw the Nova version. But they really did a great job on that. And they were having trouble with height. You know, the radar wouldn't work that close to the water. So they figured out, one guy was sitting in a play, and he was looking at the searchlights, the lights on the stage. They put big searchlights on the plane. You know, last possible second, they turned the lights on, and they, you know, I had two of them. And when the lights met each other, then they knew they were at the exact height. They were able to drop their bomb. I don't know if you ever saw that movie. It's a great movie. Back to you, Roy.
Hold on. They had clips from the movie to illustrate some of their points. No, they fully admitted to the movie, and at relevant points, they would describe something, and then they would show a clip from the movie to show how the movie addressed it.
Doc, very good. I must admit I don't remember it in the detail that you do, Ed. I remember it as soon as you said about two sentences, I remembered that I had seen that episode. Because, as I said, it's very nice. And also, it gives you a lot more insight into how engineers really do their job. Most fiction really has terrible representation of engineers. You see them just coming around their table with some kind of loopy-looking device that they built off-camera and such. You don't get to appreciate what goes on in an engineer's mind.
I do have a great Mr. Moore story, totally different topic.
Okay.
Back when I was young and handsome, or reasonably so, I was involved in a flight test of a prototype landing system called the microwave landing system that never actually got fielded by the FAA. And we had a flight test, and my fourth favorite place, Wallops Island, Virginia, there is an airport there that supports operations. And they arranged a flight test there that they sold our equipment on the airport and on a T-54. And I spent most of calendar year 1974 bouncing across the Virginia skies in that plane, doing runs and taking data. So far, so good, Roy?
Yep.
Now, the FAA does not have a good reputation for being clever and thinking outside the box. But one of those people there from the FAA was a fellow who grew up in Brooklyn, not too far from Troy. And he suggested, can we put a four-point indicator, on the dashboard and the cockpit? And we said, yeah, sure. So it was rigged up, and they had, first-point indicators, two meters, one on the bottom or one on the left. And the idea is to make the meters go for a plus sign. It shows you right where it's supposed to be. That's what they use for ILS. And we were flying the test. They were not following the line to say, but they were noticing how it was. And we knew these guys, we behaved with with them. As a matter of fact, I was with them to see Richard Nixon resign. We were at the bar in town that evening when he resigned. We were careful to go 12 hours before that flight. But anyway, I didn't have to make it. But they said, there's a bump in that thing. I said, what? And they said, yeah, well, it's winding down all of a sudden. It even goes up and then down. So, it was a group of us. We borrow a surveyor's trench, basically a rifle scope for a pair. And we set it up right where the elevation system, right above the ground. And we watched the plane come in. And sure enough, as the plane was approaching the end of the runway, we would dip and go back up. And we realized that's where the plane was flying over the Tito Creek. When the sun was hitting the grass, we were getting to see in the ground, we were getting updraft. Over Mosquito Creek, it was cold, and there was a downdraft, and the pilots put the sensors for our system and the transit system.
Ah, that's intriguing. Jeez.
I think that's a fascinating lesson. Aviation, about electronics, this is just life in general.
Yeah, that's a good story. That's interesting. Well, you know, sensitivity of the detection devices kind of run all over the place. And nowadays, I think things are a lot more sensitive than they once were. But, you know, I mean, that's the nature of development of a lot of tools that we use. Especially that we throw into space, they're more and more sensitive. So yeah, that's a fascinating story. Thank you, Wes. Wesley, do you have anything else on this subject? Keep in mind it's 10 o'clock, and we already have two other people on the list for tonight. I don't want to rush you, but. Okay, Ed.
Those flight tests were also a fascinating experience. Aviation in a decent sized plane. I mean, this plane was designed to be a 50-seat airliner. Not having to be bullied by flight attendants and having the run of the plane is so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, there are guys out there with their own private jets who have that experience every day. Are you listening, Elon?
It's not the same. Just fly smooth. This thing rattles and bounces way across the Virginia sky.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Ed. I'll give one more try. I think Wesley stepped away from the radio earlier. Wesley, are you out there?
Oh, I can't help myself. You ready?
Okay, Ed.
Those of you who are familiar with Harry Chapin's song, Taxi, will know what I'm talking about. And I don't want to quote the original AM radio. But I learned about Dramamine in the back of NASA 438.
Okay, yeah. Did you ever have a chance to ride in the Vomit Comet?
I had my fill of that good old NASA 438. No thanks.
Okay, very good, Ed. I'll try one last time. I think Wesley stepped away. Are you out there, Wesley? No, I guess not. Well, I hope it's not too much of an emergency out there. And, you know, we'll hear from Wesley again. Paul, WS2N, you had, you're next on the list.
Okay, this is WX1. And yeah, I was hoping Chris would be on tonight, STP. He had a great question last week. We were on the chat room. Well, I wasn't